Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, Producer Picks. Highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show,
people are starting to think about, oh yeah, how do we feed ourselves as a region if we're not creating a new generation of farmers, if we're not protecting farmland?
A tour of Providence Farm Collective. And we continue with
really just the intentionality of those value-added pieces, I think, is what elevates the program.
Charisma Dubois of Buffalo Center of Arts and Technology. And we close with,
we see a lot of need, especially around this time of year, and we want this program to meet those families right where they are, no matter what their circumstances are.
Alicia Stark of Child and Family Services. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. First, we revisit a tour the What's Next team took over this summer to the Providence Farm Collective. Here's Jay Moran.
Recently, What's Next executive producer Charles Gilbert and I spent a sunny Friday morning at Providence Farm Collective in Orchard Park. The intent was to tour their new building, which is a combination of a farm store, washing station, office space, storage areas, and more. And while we spoke with Executive Director Kristen Heltman-Wise and Deputy Executive Director Hamadi Ali, we also had a chance meeting with a visitor, Grace Karambizi. She's a lead organizer of the Buffalo Immigrant Leadership Team, and she talked about their recent effort to teach some of the region's newest residents on the workings of government in America.
We just finished a civic engagement, actually, training where we talked more about basically understanding the local government, who is who, who does what in the city, and we also did the budget, what is the budget, the city budget compared to the Erie County budget, as well as the state budget, and how that affects us in Buffalo and where the money is going. Because we're preparing also to have a new mayor, what are the things that the immigrant and refugees, or those most of us who have become, former immigrant and refugee, who are U.S. citizens, who participate, who vote, what are the things that we want to see in Buffalo where it is more inclusive and where our voice is heard? So, yeah, things like that.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yes.
You know, it's interesting. When you were saying that, I couldn't have wondered how, so you're explaining this to whomever your constituency might be, is interested in finding out more, they come through you.
Yes.
How confused? I mean, can you describe how long it maybe takes to kind of really try to help people understand what the way this works in Buffalo and Erie County?
So it is already confusing.
It's confusing, I know. I've been doing it for 63 years.
Most of the people who came, one day if I pass my anniversary, actually, I've been here for 21 years.
Okay.
So most of the people who really are interested have been here about 10 on average. You want to understand the government, but we also have a couple newer person who came, who still we all still figuring out what the city, okay, the county, and what is that, who does what, so it does take the time. Even after a while you figure out, okay, I don't know this. And actually one of the things that prompted it was someone who has been in the U.S. for 25 years, I was I only vote for the presidential election. And we're but locally, that's where we have much more impact. What other thing can we do locally to make sure that our voice are heard? So it is arranged, but it does take a long, long time, basically.
Right.
But I think, I believe that civic engagement is very important and understanding. So we are going to do those series and repetitively too, some information. It takes just time to get it. We have worked a lot with the school system, and it's understanding how decentralized the U.S. education system is and who does what, and like what is the role of even of the board, like once you go outside of like the district, like if you are in another district, like it takes time. And some people is not into like maybe they have moved or like going into another in the suburbs, they realize, oh, my child cannot be going to the referral school. So it does really take a long time. Like on average, sometimes you just learn by error.
So where are you originally from, Grace?
That's another question. I was born in Rwanda. But I think like I spent so much time outside of the U.S. because I left when I was 8. And being a refugee in Congo, DRC, back when it was Zaire. I stayed there for 2 years and then we were brought back in 1996 to Rwanda. I stayed in Rwanda for 1 year and then my family also have to flee. And then been in Ivory Coast for 7 years before. So Cote d'Ivoire, they don't like to be the country to be translated in English. Been in Cote d'Ivoire for about 7 years before we were resettled in Buffalo, New York in 2004, September 14th.
So. You both came.
Yeah.
Hamadi came in the fall of 2004.
Yeah.
Literally month apart.
Yeah,
came in August of 2024, August 11th.
Yeah,
2004.
2004,
that's,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So.
And so, how about what brought you out to Providence Farm?
Well, Providence Farm. Personally, I came because that's like my mental health. Like I like to be here. Like, I signed up to volunteer, so I came to. I was like, okay, this is a perfect occasion. I haven't been able to be here the entire summer. I can come and spend some time outside of the city, but like also supporting PFC. So I know a lot of the farmers and buy produce from them. Attend the market. Often as much as possible. It's just, I think it's a place of peace. So the first, that's why I came here, but it's also supporting. I'm always like, I talk about PFC, like I feel like Pacific Christian should hire me to do marketing. No, seriously, in every space, I'm like, you should see PFC, you should come and check it out. And even people like, because a lot of our community members also have like garden in the back of their house, and I'm like, you should come and check it out. There's land that people who are doing this, like, and also really knowing that you eating organic food, like something that is grown out of like the land. Many of us haven't really experienced that. Actually, I did not experience that until I started knowing more about like PFC, because you just go to the market and that's, you know, the supermarket, and you grab what you need. But I think there is something of being here and seeing the plants grow, or like, and seeing actually also the face of the other farmers, like how they feel. Like I was speaking with a couple of them because I've known them for a couple years. Just like the joy, like, you know, to be able to be in the field picking like their crops, things that they have done themselves, I think is just is amazing. When I think of PFC, I always think about mental health. It's access to food, definitely, but like even a notch, you know, father, is that we talk a lot about mental health for immigrants and refugees, and that's something that is familiar to them. It's something that is a skill that they bring in and they are able to enhance it. So they have more joy. They have joy here.
Grace Karambizi of the Buffalo Immigrant Leadership Team, who we met during our recent visit at the Providence Farm Collective. This is What's Next. I'm Jay Moran, along with executive producer Charles Gilbert. Our tour with PFC's Hamadi Ali and Kristen Heltman-Wise followed some turbulent months for the organization. earlier this year, their grant from the U.S. Department of Agriculture was canceled. The reason, as it was explained in a somewhat baffling letter, a PFC program did not coincide with Trump administration priorities regarding DEI initiatives. Through a lawsuit, that funding has been restored, though there is a sense of resignation. They may be forced to eventually return the dollars to the federal government.
With all the negatives we have experienced, but this season seems like it's been a very successful season. Actually, I and the markets manager were doing a field walk yesterday, and I was explaining it. I was like, hey, I've been here for 5 years. I was the markets manager and doing field walks, and around this time of the year, I've been struggling to find produce to put in our CSA and donate. But this year, not as much. We have a lot in the fields.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, I mean, it's been a great growing summer, hasn't it?
It has. It has been dry, but also it's been great.
Yeah.
So I don't know how the two reconcile, but it's been a very
somehow
good...
it's all worked out together.
Yes, it did.
We'll take it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, lead the way. So this is the new place here.
This is the new place, and that is the old place.
I've been in the old place.
Yes.
I was heading that way, actually.
Yeah, probably all three of you need a mark. That used to be our old wash and pack station, and I will show you the new one in
okay.
here, so you can see the difference.
All right, very good. Very good.
Wow. Wow.
This is our farm store.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, we're super excited. I don't know. There's the lights, finally. So, how often we open?
2 days a week now. A Monday from 3 to 7 for our CSA members and also for the public to come and shop. And then Thursday from 11 to 4. Those are the 2 days that we are open, but we are in the works of thinking, adding more days to that.
Are you selling just produce from here?
Just from Providence Farm Collective.
Okay.
As of yesterday, we got a refrigerator and a freezer, and we have some meats from other farms. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh,
they
wow.
were in there, but I had to take them out because I didn't know if that was on and how to turn it on. So I took the meat in a different freezer, so
yeah,
it wouldn't.
So we're starting to stock meat. Eggs, milk, and other things that people have asked for. We're also working on, so over the winter, shelving's going to be built and different sorts of displays and stuff. So we're really excited. Last year, we started a small hive, so we have bees. We sell PFC bees.
Wow.
Or bees, honey.
How much honey are you making?
Not a ton, but it's at least a couple hundred jars a year.
Wow.
It's been so far, and they sell. This is all that's left right
sure.
now. So so that's been really great. We love this space in that we've been able to thank our supporters for the Capital campaign in a way that represents us. So we worked with Stitch Buffalo Artisans. To create their representation of agriculture, and they made these beautiful quilt squares, and you'll see donors' names on them. We worked with Brendan Bannon a couple years ago on a cyanotype project. We actually have some cyanotypes that are 20 by 15 feet that have families on them with the vegetables they grow.
Oh, okay.
But this is one that one of our farmers wrote a poem on, and so we have that. We have a local orchard park farmer who in March gifted that hoe. It's over 100 years old. It was his great-grandfather's. He used it on the farm not far from here, and he had that plaque made. And when he gave it to Hamadi, he said, I just want to say thank you for continuing the legacy of agriculture in Orchard Park.
Wow.
So it's we hope when people come here, they just feel very welcomed and at home and the warmth of this community.
Do you feel that it's expanding, that embracing of what you're doing out here?
I think it is, and I think as people learn more and more about us and the fact that we're the only incubator farm program west of Ithaca, and that program, because of the grant termination, is at risk, people are starting to think about, oh yeah, how do we feed ourselves as a region if we're not creating a new generation of farmers, if we're not protecting farmland, you know, if we're letting developers just come in and build houses mm-hmm. in space that, you know, there's prime agricultural soils, that puts us all at risk. And so I think as people learn, everybody enters at a different level, but they get it. They're thinking about it now. And I think that that's been really good.
Is it the wrong time and wrong venue to talk about the grant and where that stands at a legal standpoint?
So, no, it's not wrong. Okay. Legally, it's still in the pipeline. So the lawsuit's still progressing through the federal courts. We did receive a positive ruling for a motion for preliminary injunction. So that asks the courts to reinstate our funding until the lawsuit goes through. So finally, it took about 3 weeks, we were finally able to get into our USDA portal, request the funding. We now have that, but we're concerned because chances are we will have to pay back that money. I don't know, the way the courts are ruling right now, especially at the Supreme Court level, I don't know that we're going to end up winning this. And you might ask, like, why are we doing it in the first place? We're doing it because we're so unique in this region, and food system-wise, we know what the pandemic did to our community and how it really put so many people in harm's way, including farmers, because farmers were in this position where they had been pushed, our dairy farmers, to, like, if you're going to survive, you need to produce for an institutional setting. You need to produce for a school district. So all of their packaging was that. The pandemic hit, schools shut down, and they're having to throw away milk because it's not packaged, right? So we really need to be mindful of the fact that we need all kinds of farm operations to be self-sustaining and feed ourselves in this region. We need to protect our farmland. We need to make sure our farmers are paid fairly, but we also need farmers. So we do that uniquely here, and that's really important.
Part of what you're doing out here, of course, is like you're saying, and this is, I think, what the grant, the core of the grant is, in essence, teaching people how to become farmers or be part of agriculture. Has anybody stepped out and gone out to try to do it on their own yet, or is that just a little too early to have that?
We have a farmer right now who is doing that in an urban setting. So he's on the east side of Buffalo. He's still waiting to get like the lease signed. So he's signing a 99-year lease with a land trust to farm that land, and the land trust, they're working out all the agreements right now, but he's there right now, and he's also here because we offer that wraparound support. So it's really exciting for him. Hamadi early on saw that Condola was like really good at identifying his customers and serving them.
Okay.
And he very quickly just needed more land, more opportunity. So now he has that. Do you want to talk a little bit about how he's, like, he lives close to that land and what that's meant?
Condola, so he lives close to the land, and like almost every farmer here has another job. So transportation is a challenge. And if you own your own car, you have to at least drive 45 to 30 minutes here, and having that farm close to his home, that is a plus. And as Kristen alluded to, Condola has early on identified his market. He doesn't even sell the PFC. He grows specialty crops, and he knows exactly where to take them. And the farm in the city, right on, he's like, my customers will come here, grab this stuff, and get to take the produce to wherever they feel like taking it.
So how big is that lot in the city that he's going to do the urban farming at?
I think the farm itself is about an acre, but he only farms in a quarter acre now.
Okay. And he hopes to build it out. So we last year were able to start helping our farmers apply for grants. And so they've been getting grants for like small tractors, walk behind equipment. And that's been really good. And then Condola's been working with the land trust to also identify like some other needs that he has. Our team went and helped him set up irrigation this year over there. So it really is like this partnership across many organizations that come together to support our farmers. It's been pretty fantastic. And then we have, this is another thing we've been working on, is we've had a lot of challenges accessing public water, for example, here. And some of that is based on the fact that the definition of a farm operation legally is quite archaic. It's basically a family, a homestead. They're growing food or producing something agriculturally. And because we are many farms, 31 small farms on 37 acres, under this nonprofit collective model, we weren't considered a farm operation. So as a result, the mechanisms that are in place to protect farmers couldn't be used. Mm. We couldn't call Ag and Markets to say, please help defend us. And we are really lucky because at all of those meetings, we're members of the Farm Bureau. They showed up at those meetings and spoke out in favor of us. We've been working with the Farm Bureau the past couple of years on that idea of how do we change that definition of a farm operation. There are a lot of other different kinds of farms across the state, but we were the ones who, you know, have been asked to do this work, and we're doing it in partnership with the Farm Bureau and support of Ag and Markets to get this changed.
Started to hear you say that the Farm Bureau is supporting you. Are you also, or inside that, getting support from so-called, if there are really legacy farmers, there aren't a lot of them around anymore, I guess, but are you finding people who are farming are supportive of what you're doing out here?
Yeah, Farm Bureau are those legacy members.
I figured as much, but I wanted to make sure I understood
that. They are, yeah. And they're the ones who have for generations been stewarding our farmland across the state. And they're the ones who actually work really hard to protect farmers, to protect our food system. Often they're asked to do things that I think we don't understand fully. You know, it's all farmers that struggle for viability. It's the model that it seems the USDA is promoting right now is more industrial agriculture, corporate farming, and that is worrisome in that it takes a lot out of the land. It's a different kind of farming. And it's not necessarily to feed people healthy foods. It's not mixed vegetables, right? And so I think the fact that you have these legacy farmers who understand the importance that people need a diverse selection of agricultural products and a region needs and should have the opportunity to identify how they're self-sufficient in feeding one another. I think that they're all very much in favor of that. And I really appreciate that with their leadership and their support of this farm.
That was a tour of the Providence Farm Collective. Next, Akua Menzedu speaks with Charisma Dubois, Senior Program Director at the Buffalo Center of Arts and Technology. She speaks about her role at the center and much more.
So, Charisma, I am super excited to talk to you today about your role at BCAT. So you're the Senior Program Director. And just coming off the elevator, right, I entered into the space and it was a light. There were students all around, you know, they were in their Halloween costumes, eating candy, really excited. And I just want to get a sense of like what it is that you do in your role.
So my role is to oversee all program here at BCAT. And what that means is I do everything from curriculum development to ensuring the day-to-day of the program is running smoothly, strategy for the program, because I work really closely with the leadership team to just make sure that we're making the impact that we want to make and we're moving in the right direction. And then I disseminate a lot of information to my team so that they can execute and ensure that our students are successful. And if there are any things that come up, we want to make sure that we take care of it, address it, and move forward.
And so as we walked around, I mean, you saw bright faces, people excited about what they were doing. We saw the digital media room. We saw the music room where there are little keyboards and, you know, connected to Macs. And we saw fine arts where people were drawing and painting. And so how did y'all come up with your programming and what do you hope folks take from it?
BCAT stands for the Buffalo Center for Arts and Technology. And there are a bunch of cats around the world. And really, the goal of the cat model is to create an environment that fosters, you know, creativity and really helps people feel like they can do anything. The model is really, if you create an environment for someone, they will thrive and they'll rise to the occasion. And so that's what we do here. For our youth, providing arts and technology is an outlet for them. It's an opportunity for them to be creative, but it's also a way for them to explore things they would have never had a chance to be a part of. And so you would think someone coming here and doing like the 3D printing class might, you know, go into manufacturing or something, but students do a lot after this program. You know, we have a student that is in school right now to become an architect because there's skills that you learn in these classes that you wouldn't have explored somewhere else. And so our goal is for students to be able to come here, learn, but determine what parts of this program resonates with them, what can they take with them, and how can they use that to find a pathway in life?
And I love that because you could see the excitement in the students' faces. There's a certain level of comfort that they have, even with instructors, a certain level of camaraderie, even with themselves. And I know as we went through, I think it was the media room that we went through, and I was just like, this is a place that I would love to hang out, right? And especially as a student. And so how did you all, like, what was... It was obviously intentional in terms of how you created and structured what this looks like, and you moved here to create more of that type of space. So talk about that intentionality and how folks entered the space.
In our previous space, it was still a welcoming environment, right? Because that's at the center of BCAT. But it wasn't an environment where students could call their own. Many of the classes shared space. And so when choosing a new space, we wanted to make sure that each room was tailored to the learning that the students needed for themselves. And so you see in the music room, there's an intentionality there in terms of you have a space where you can record your music. You have a space where you can mix it. You have a space where you can put your headphones on, add your beats, and do what you need to do in there. And all the students know those different spaces. They're all welcome to come in each space, but they truly make the space their own. And so when you go into, say, like the digital room, you see all the student artwork. They made that space creative in the way that it looks, you know, and all we do is provide them with the tools to get there. Everything else is on them.
So when you think about success stories, right, because we kept hearing different stories all along. So 100% graduation rate. We talked to Tierra and the phlebotomy program, 100% graduation rate as well. So how did y'all get to that point, right? Like how the magic, there must be some type of magic that's happening.
There's a little bit of magic, but there's a lot of learning and growing. So when I came to BCAT, I was tasked with looking at our programs, determining what's going well, and deciding what are the things we need to improve on. And so that's exactly what I did. I started by interviewing every single staff member to see what they loved about BCAT, what's going well with the processes, and how we can improve. Tiara's a rock star. Mm-hmm. Okay. She put her all into her curriculum. And what I gave to her is my background in Beck's teaching practices, because she's a content expert. So I'm a former educator. And so I bring that with me into this space. And so with Tiara, I really just sat down and worked with her. You know, you have all this great content. Let's make sure that students are engaged. Let's make sure you know that they're understanding the material. That's something that we didn't do in the past. So we have like professional development for our instructors, right? Because it's a creative space, it's a technical space. But at the end of the day, all of our instructors are industry experts. They're not teachers, right? And you can know a lot, but that doesn't mean you can teach someone, right? So that's where I come in. And then when it comes to the other classes, I'm really data driven. So just making sure that the data is telling a story that we want it to tell. And if it's not, where are we, you know, going wrong? And so with the IT classes, really taking a look at what type of professional development we're offering to students. Is it tailored to the pathway they want, you know, they want to go into? IT students are very different than allied health students, right? They're not going to be in front of people. So their professional development doesn't necessarily need to focus on customer service in that way. But they do need to be able to talk to a customer about the issues that they're having and how to troubleshoot those issues. But they're not there to make them feel comfortable and not scared of a needle or whatever it is that our allied health students are experiencing. So taking a look at that and making sure that the opportunities and experiences students are getting out of this program actually align with the career path that they're going into and is meaningful. So really just the intentionality of those value added pieces, I think, is what elevates the program. Because our content experts, they're amazing. They know their content. Students are going to get that. It's all the other pieces they need to be successful that we have to own and make sure is, you know, tailored to the students.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, even hearing Tiara's story and how she went from a student to now being the teacher, and she didn't have teaching background, to your point, right? And so that was something that you all worked with her to get her prepared for that. And I kept hearing these stories about, oh, I'm a non-traditional student, or I came from this specific space. Generational wealth was important to me. And so I knew that if I got into this tech program, I could see a different type of future for myself and my family. You also heard stories of, hey, I didn't have childcare that day and I just brought my kid with me. And that was something that was welcomed. And so I want you to talk a little bit more and lean into that, right? This non-traditional student, and how do you take them into this current space and then produce what they came here to do?
I think of non-traditional students as the ones that took the squiggly path. They didn't take a straight path. Like me, I took a straight path. I went to school for education. I became a teacher.
Right.
And now I'm running a program where essentially I'm like a principal of this program. That's how I compare it. Whereas a lot of our students, maybe they have not gone to college, or they went and it wasn't for them, or maybe they went to college, but that industry that they went into is just not the industry that's still there. You know, there's a few students like that as well, but most students have had various experiences when they come to us. Our allied health students, a lot of them work in the field, but in roles that don't pay a lot and roles that is physically demanding, and they're coming here so that they can get a certification and move up into a position that's going to put them on the right path. And Tiara talked about that in her story, because that it really changed the trajectory of her life. Whereas our IT students, when they come to us, they might have had a long career, because I think the average age of our IT students are like 33, whereas our allied health students are 25. But our IT students, when they come to us, they may have worked in retail. Some have worked in healthcare, but many of them have had a lot of different experiences and tried things that just didn't work for them. And so for them, it's really about highlighting those transferable skills and making sure that they know that they have a lot to offer to the field. Mm-hmm. You know, if you worked in retail, you are folding clothes, taking orders,
project
manager,
yep,
you're doing a lot of stuff. All of that stuff is, you know, those skills are transferable. So just making sure students know that And the same with our allied health students, you know, making sure that they know that they have the skill set to move into those pathways. With our youth, our goal is really to provide those experiences because they're blank. They're a blank canvas, right? They have experiences, but they're just, you know, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and they're just excited. And so it's our job to just make sure that they are exposed because, you know, digital media arts seems so cool and fun, but they have no idea what kind of career you can go into. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot of students and there's not a lot of people in those career fields that look like our students. And so exposure, making sure that they know what it can take to get into those spaces. Not everything takes a college degree, but if it does, what major do you need to go into? What experiences do you need? What internships do you need? Right. But trying to do that early on, you know, I don't know if we talked about it, but especially in our youth program, we do a lot of work with other partners. And so students will get commissioned to do different things. They might get commissioned to do artwork, murals, music. You know, there's a bank that came and wanted our 3D printing students to create a trophy for them. They came in like, oh, can y'all make us a trophy? You know, so those experiences we give students, give them the tools to make a decision on what they want to do when they get out of here. It's not straightforward. Yeah. It's a squiggly path.
And I love that because I think, you know, when you even think about like art specifically, there's portfolios that you usually have to have to even get into college and be able to showcase some of that. And traditionally, I don't know if that's an easy thing to navigate, right? Without having something like this and it being exposed.
Yes, it could be difficult to create a portfolio if you don't know how and you don't have the skill set. But students, every project, they take photos of the work that they do and we store it for them. We, you know, catalog it so that they can take it with them. You know, but like I said, just because they come here for art doesn't mean that's the pathway that they go into. Some students have gone to school for art. We got architecture. We got a student that's in school for forensic chemistry. Right. So they just learn the skills here and kind of pick out the parts that they really like and they take it and run with it. And we're all here for it.
So you mentioned earlier you were a data person, right? I would say like a data diva probably, right? So can you talk a bit about some of the success stories that you've seen? Any metrics that are sticking out for you that you want to share?
Sure. We talked a little bit about our phlebotomy program because Tiara has a wonderful pass rate. Her pass rate is 100%. But for our allied health program as a whole, it's a 91% pass rate across classes.
Amazing.
And that's our pharmacy tech, medical, administrative assistant, and phlebotomy classes. Our students historically across the programs get into jobs 70% of the time right within the first 3 months. And then we have some resources on the back end. We're actually now building out our alumni council to help those that didn't get into that job right away. So how can we help them get there? Our IT program has a 93% pass rate and a 76% certification rate, which is still pretty good. Mm-hmm. I know Giselle talked about how rigorous the program is. Those are accelerated programs. They're not easy. They're national certifications and you have to study hard. And if you're working during the day, like some of our students are, finding time to study in between taking care of your kids and doing everything you have to do can definitely be a lot. Of our IT students, about 70% of them have jobs. And I would say 40% of them are in an IT specific job, like an actual IT role. And then we have about 30% of that 70 that are in like IT adjacent roles. So those are roles where you use technology, but you're not necessarily doing help desk or, you know, setting up a network for people or like doing a security for a company. Though we've had some students get into some pretty, you know, high level position. We have a student right now that's finishing up our security class. She actually was able to land a job at M&T Bank on their security team. She was worried that we were going to kick her out the program because now she's this high level security person. And I'm like, girl, we are not kicking you out. We got to help you finish your pathway.
Right.
You know, so she's doing really great. We have a student who really leaned into networking. For IT, you have to network. It's really who you know, especially here in Buffalo. And so she leaned into that, got to know so many people in the IT space. And then she was just hired in her first IT job doing it for Canisius College, which is a pretty big deal, you know, to have that type of job right out of a program. I wouldn't even say right out of a program because she's still here. She's got one more class that she's doing with us. We have a student that went to a shadow day. So I set up a shadow day at a local IT company and I sent a bunch of students there. And the goal was for them to just speak to individuals that worked in this space and ask them what their pathway was, right? Because students come here, especially in IT, and they're like, I'm going to be a security person. And it's like, in 20 years you will.
Right.
It takes a lot to get to that level where you're trusted to own the security of a company. Mm-hmm. And so it's not something that's not doable. It just takes a lot of time and practice and expertise. But this particular company that I sent our students to, they were just open to a shadow day. I'm like, okay, we'll see how it goes. Then they emailed us maybe a day or two later. We loved your students. Everyone's singing their praises. We're going to bring one on for internship over the summer, a paid internship. Okay, fine. I'll send them over. I'll get their resume, send them over, have them interview. Now the student that was chosen for that internship, she's employed there. And we actually use them for our IT services. So she's still in class with us. And then she's also troubleshooting any computer issues we have. Like the internet was down one time and she got so excited. Like, oh, I'm going to fix it. And then it came back on and she was like, I didn't get to do it. But everybody was so excited for her. Like, yay, you did it. So there's so many successful stories. And our students come back to us. You know, when we have mock interviews for the next generation of students, our alumni come back and they're now in the field. They want to give back to students. And so they give them the pointers. And so we want to continue to lean into that and make sure alumni have opportunities to give back. But also we need our students to network and know those that are in the industry and have mentors.
So I think one of the last things I want to just ask you about, because you mentioned other companies and other businesses that you're engaged with, and it sounds like there's some really rich partnerships that have happened that you're connecting students directly with opportunities, whether that's internships and jobs. And so can you speak to maybe a business or a company that might be interested in learning more about what BCAT does and maybe how they get involved with you all?
So there are so many ways to get involved with BCAT. I think the easiest low-hanging fruit is to come and speak to our students, right? Our students love to hear from industry experts. We always do panel discussions as a part of their professional development. So that's an easy way to just come in and share about the work that you do and how you got to where you are. But there's also opportunities to have an even bigger impact, you know, and people from different companies will come and they'll do mock interviews with us. If they have positions that are open, this is an easy way for them to, you know, not spend so much money and actually hire people. And so we've had recruiters from different companies come and participate in our mock interviews, and students have gotten hired from that because sometimes you just need to meet the students. I think that's why that shadow day worked so well, because you don't know what you're getting from a student that's going through a program like this, because people are so used to having those with college degrees be the ones at the forefront. So shadow days is always an opportunity, building out an actual partnership. So we had a big healthcare partner that built out a new pathway in partnership with us. So they were a part of the curriculum planning. They were a part of the professional development and really invested in it. So if there's a company that has opportunities and they have jobs that are open and they have a lot of turnover, as you know, some of these companies do, the best way to combat that is to be a part of the planning, you know, and really create the environment for the employees that you want to bring into your business. And so we've done that, which is really great. And then there's other companies, maybe they can't afford to hire someone. That doesn't mean we don't want to partner with you. Maybe you could afford to give someone an experience, because people always need experiences. So we do have partners that are building out internships with us and doing things like that. I think sky's the limit. I'm open to so many partnerships, right? Because I'm only one person. I don't know everything. And people have really great ideas and really great ways to be innovative. And I want that for BCAT. You know, I think we have so much to give, but we have so much more to learn.
I love that. And I love the work that you all are doing here. It's inspiring. You see the faces here. People want to be here. Yeah. Definitely want to be here.
You've they created. Show up.
Yeah, exactly. Right. You create an environment where people want to show up. They want to be here. And so congratulations to you and your team for the work that you're doing. And so I'm going to ask you if you could describe BCAT in one word, what would it be and why?
For me, BCAT is opportunity. That's my one word, because Tierra said it. She came here for a program that she thought was going to be the program that she was going to get into. Ended up doing a program that really changed the trajectory of her life. I think when our students come here to BCAT, they have in their idea of what they're, you know, in their mind, an idea of what they want to do and where they want to go. But once they get here and they have these different opportunities to experience just the space, the staff, the other students, the professional development, the content in the class, they really start to open their mind to the possibilities. I think it's so funny that many of our IT students come here and they're like, I'm going to be a security guru, but they have no idea whether you want to work in healthcare or you want to work here or you want to work there. And I always tell them, like, every place is not an IT company, but every place needs IT. Right. And so you can do really important work anywhere. It doesn't have to be in that place that you think you should be, because that's like where everyone thinks you should go. But yeah, it's a place of opportunity. And that's why I came here. You know, I want to support individuals as a whole. I know you can't do it by just going to class. You know, I was a teacher, not during the pandemic. I was an instructional coach during the pandemic, trying to support educators. And it was very hard because, you know, you didn't know what students were going through. You saw them on the camera. And so after that, I really wanted to come to a place where it's not just about whether you're passing the class, but are you okay as a human? And how can we help you be okay? How can we help you get to your goals? And then you're still intact when you get there.
And we close out with Alicia Stark, Development Manager at Child and Family Services. She tells us about the Adopt a Family program and how the program supports more than 1,000 people each year during holiday season.
You're enthusiastic about this program. Why so enthusiastic?
Adopt a Family is the best time of the year. Selfishly, as a fundraiser, someone who works in donor relations, the connection opportunities between the community, the families that Child and Family Services serves, and just you can't equate it to any other time of the year. People want to support others during the holiday season. Buffalo, as the city of good neighbors, the amount of emails I get per day of how can I help? You know, what's this program that you have going on? There's no way to not be excited. Adopt a Family supports families in need. A lot of people are familiar with Adopt a Family in general.
Sure. The name in itself has a certain understanding to it.
Yeah. Specifically for Child and Family Services, Adopt a Family is our biggest event of the year. Hmm. We invite local donors in the community, as I mentioned. They come in and they volunteer. We have a full workshop on our campus where we sort gifts, organize them, and prepare them for delivery for the families in our services that can participate in our program.
And so when we're talking about the things that are going to be delivered, they are wide-ranging.
The items that get brought in through this program are anything from socks, underwear, toolkits, gift cards to Dick's Sporting Goods, Ulta, Sephora. We got a lot of teens with, niche requests. It's a chance to ask families in our services, what could you need? What would benefit your life better? But then we ask, What would you want? You know, so we do see the basic necessities, the amount of families that need toilet paper, cleaning supplies, you know, a spin mop, brand new pillows, mattresses. Those requests are the really hearty ones, that those are the needs we immediately want to be met through this program. But we also want the brand new toys, Bluetooth headphones for our young kids, Nerf footballs, you know, books, spa items for mom and dad, grandpa, whoever potentially the caregivers are for the littles in our services. We see a lot of need especially around this time of year. And we want this program to meet those families right where they are, no matter what their circumstances are.
You've done this now for 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What about the need? The need, is there a sense that it's growing?
The need is absolutely growing. From what I've heard, specifically in the nonprofit realm, like COVID has really let people be able to talk about what's going on in their homes far more than ever before, especially with SNAP benefits being cut this past year. We have a lot of families who are experiencing extreme hardship, and it's our pleasure to be able to provide case planners, counselors, who are able to advocate on behalf of those families and say, this family needs to be in this program. And then from there, my team gets involved and we make sure that they're matched with a donor and they're able to participate in the program fully.
So take us through that then. So lots of people with mm-hmm. needs. You can only help out so many every year, but obviously glad to do what you can. And,
yeah.
and it sounds like the community gets behind you as well. But how do we go about finding which families are going to be part of the Adopt a Family program?
Yeah. The program itself is only available to individuals who are already under the umbrella of Child and Family Services.
And how do you get under that umbrella?
You are through the state, truly, or just through our general counseling. You're able to talk to your case planner, talk to whoever is your true provider in home, whether that's, we have skill builders, whether that's foster care, our Stanley G. Falk School. If you're in those programs through the several different layers of referrals or sure. need, we're able to come right alongside you and, you know, get you into
okay.
the program itself.
Okay. I appreciate the clarification yeah. in that regard. But so then to take it though. So now that's how we get the understanding of the need, the yeah. level of need.
Level of need. Yeah. Then our case planners, they are able to refer 4 to 5 of their top neediest families that are in their case planning, you know, of the year.
Oh, wow.
So it's definitely a hard job for a lot of our staff because they have to compare where families are at. Families can come and go, and we want to also be mindful of if we know they're going to leave, let's set them up for success and keep them there. You know, there's so many different things that can change. We want to make sure that they feel that they are seen specifically, you know, through December and into, you know, the new year through this program.
You're not a case manager.
No.
I'm going to ask you to kind of put yourself in their situation, but how does a case manager then, because obviously they're dealing with more than just 5 cases, right?
Yes.
So how do they go through making this decision or figuring out who might best benefit from this opportunity?
That's a great question. And I think it almost speaks to the beauty of our agency as a whole. When you join Child and Family Services and we are, you know, officially supporting you in some way or another, there are so many different avenues that different individuals in your family can also partake in. So we have some survivors of domestic violence who maybe their children then need counseling or preventive work. In that case, we're able to pull up their file and see that they're being served 2 ways. The whole family is able to take part through our adoptive family, even if just one kid is there. So we're able to see and move around families based on where their support truly is. But it's the beauty that they're supported through multiple programs, potentially.
Sure.
But it's
probably not uncommon.
Not uncommon at right. all. And we do our best to make sure that each year new families are being supported through this program. We want the cycle to continue for healing and growth. If a family needed support 2 years in a row, we wouldn't just match them with a donor. We want to make sure, have we done everything else to make sure that they're set up for success rather than just holiday gifts, you know, gift cards, you name it.
So how many families are going to be part of this program? And does that depend on how much is donated, or is it depend, or do you already have a set number in mind, or how does that work?
So this year, our matches are being made as we speak.
Okay.
We're almost at like the very end with all of our families being matched with local donors, which is amazing.
Okay.
Normally, we have around 300 to 315 families okay. that are supported through this program. That's around 1,300 individuals. And we want more families to be supported each year. Even this year, we requested our case planners to refer 1 more family. Just because this year was particularly hard from what we've seen, heard, and as someone who looks at their wish list, it's true that more support is needed. It used to just be, let's make sure families receive mattresses. Like, that is our main priority. Now it's, they need cleaning supplies. They need winter boots, winter jackets, mittens. And that's something we've really tried to emphasize to our donors and community as well, as it's not just gifts. It's not the sparkly items. It's things that make someone feel that they can have dignity and feel empowered to prioritize themselves. You know, mental health is so hard, and who wants to work on that if you're cold, if you're not getting good sleep? So that's the beauty of our program.
The donors then, how, that this really, this is where it falls under you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, who are these individuals that donate?
These individuals could truly be anyone. It could be your neighbor. It could be a local wine club, book club, churches. We have a lot of corporate sponsors as well who are absolutely wonderful. They adopt families. They don't just give money. They adopt 4 or 5 families, and then they even come and volunteer with us. But our donors could be anyone. We offer adoption for these Christmas lists. And what that looks like is you can say how many individuals you're able to support, because we want it to be inclusive for the donor as well. And given, you know, economic hardship, it's okay if you just want to adopt one person, or if you just want to give gift cards or just a winter boots, whatever it may be.
But at the same time, it sounds like a great opportunity for somebody who wants to donate or support this, in the sense that maybe they can do something that's going to make a comprehensive difference for a family at this time of the year. So what might that entail then? So let's, you know, would somebody say, I want to adopt a family? What's your next step?
So we ask them, well, how many individuals do you think you're able to provide for?
Sure.
We request that around $150 to $200 is spent per individual in a family.
Okay.
Because things are expensive, and we want to make sure that, you know, mom and dad aren't just getting gas and grocery gift cards, which are amazing. However, you know, there are so many other things to make them feel seen and not just worry about kids' wish lists as well. But what a donor does is they apply on our website. From there, we look at their requests, and we actually have a database that shows us all of the families that have been referred to this program. From there, we match individually. There's no auto-generated anything. We want to personalize it. So we have some donors who say, hey, I got 2 little girls at home. Would you mind matching me with a family that has 2 little girls?
Really?
And if we have the ability to do so, and if we have a specific family, we want to make that match, because it makes it so much realer to shop for someone that could have easily been me in another world.
So a lot of families or donors are doing that? They're kind of the structure that you're just talking about, right?
Yeah, they do. We have a lot of very specific requests. At the end of the day, our favorite is when they just say, I want to help, put me to work, you know, because then I'm like, oh, I have a wish list for you, because we get to see their personality through the wish lists. Like, that is one of my favorite parts, is I'll have a donor call me and they're asking, you know, could you double check, you know, this size boot for me? And I'm like, I would love to, because in that moment, I'm able to then, first of all, be on the phone with a donor who has phenomenal intentions. You know, it's not just thank you for your donation. It's let's work together to make sure this child or this individual has what they need or what they want. So then I'm able to talk a little bit about that family's wish list to the donor, and those individuals, they come back year after year, or they then partner with us for so much longer because it was personalized.
We were talking with Alicia Stark of Child and Family Services. She's the development manager, and we're talking about, I guess, could I call it your pet project, Adopt a Family? Would that be okay?
Yeah, that works.
Adopt a Family. You talked about the personality of a wish list. So I'll always step aside when it comes to getting too confidential or breaking confidential, obviously. But at the same time, could you maybe take us through a list that you might say that shows a personality? Because I think this is a way to kind of understand what people are looking for, what, you know, what really makes a difference for somebody.
Yeah. On a wish list, we first have if the family has a vehicle, what type of entertainment they have, but then it's family-wide requests. That's that first little bit of information. And oftentimes, they're asking for outdoor activities to do. They're asking for opportunities to go to the zoo for the movies. If they don't have a vehicle, they'll usually put, you know, passes for Uber, Lyft, NFTA, Metro, you name it.
You connect with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's when we're able to say, family just moved into a brand new home, or family was homeless, looking for their like long-term place to call home.
And that will do it for Producer Picks. We'd like to thank our guests. If you missed anything or you want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is also available online at btpm.org. I'm executive producer Charles Gilbert. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.